You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, August 8th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, the most powerful committee you've never heard of. Haley Sweetland Edwards on the shadowy cartel of doctors that controls Medicare. Also on the program today, more on the NSA-DEA parallel evidence narratives that they developed. DC cops spying on protests against what appears to be DC statutes. More from Chief Kessler, the Pennsylvania police chief. You don't have that clip? Well, you got to pull it. We were talking about it yesterday. And Rick Santorum on how you libs make it impossible to take a shower these days. And didn't get to the story yesterday. Cory Booker. I guess Waywire, just another way of saying sort of not really a bribe, but sort of, you know, bribey. And a wonderful adjunct story of nepotism with Cory Booker. He's more than likely going to be the next senator from New Jersey. Which is a damn shame. Rush Holt is also running in that race, but we should be very well aware of who Cory Booker is, ladies and gentlemen. And before we get to any of that, Cory Booker's friends at J.P. Morgan Chase disclosed on Wednesday that it faces criminal and civil investigations into whether it sold shoddy mortgage securities to investors in the run-up to the financial crisis. I can save the investigators time. They did. But that's not my job. J.P. Morgan acknowledged for the first time the existence of the investigation in quarterly regulatory filings. This is from the New York Times. It says the Civil Division of the United States Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of California has preliminarily concluded that J.P. Morgan flouted, as opposed to broke, I guess. Can't bring themselves to say that in the deal book at New York Times. Federal laws with its sale of subprime mortgage securities from 05 to 07. The parallel criminal inquiry, according to one person briefed on the matter, is in a more preliminary stage. Federal prosecutors in Philly are also examining whether J.P. Morgan duped investors into buying troubled mortgage securities that later imploded. I can also help out with that investigation. They did. Prosecutors are investigating whether J.P. Morgan churned out the mortgage-backed securities without ensuring that the investments met underwriting standards. Indeed. So it's good at least that there's some, I guess, some investigations. Again, we are nearing at least some of the statutory limitations on all of these shenanigans. But hopefully we'll see some activity in the near future. Don't hold your breath, but hope springs eternal. We're going to take a break and spring into this break. And then when we come back, Haley Sweetland Edwards on the shadowy cartel of doctors that controls Medicare. Back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Pleasure to welcome back to the program Haley Sweetland Edwards, editor with the Washington Monthly. Haley, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So you've got the cover story in the this month's Washington Monthly entitled Special Deal. It really is a stunning story as we talk about the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And health care has obviously been a big issue over the past couple of years, the rising costs, although we're starting to see them plateau a little bit at the moment. And we're talking about nearly 18%, 19% of our GDP. And the basis of this cost has to do, well, I mean, this story about this committee that essentially sets prices for Medicare, much of the expense of our health care sort of emanates out of this.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a sort of a small part of the larger problem, but its implications are enormous. It's this small group of specialist doctors, each of whom represents their specialty society, and sits in this room that is behind closed doors. The media is not invited, neither is the public, and they collectively come up with how much Medicare should reimburse doctors for each individual service. So there are literally a list of 9,000 services, and they decide how much a doctor should be paid for inserting a heart stent or how much they should be paid for, you know, any number of medical procedures.
And so the committee is called the Specialty Society Relative Value Scale Update Committee.
Right, it's a mouthful.
Or RUC. And
RUC, yes. And everyone in the world calls it the RUC.
And it's convened by the AMA, which is really important in terms of I guess we will come to understand why it's important that it's convened by the AMA. But so, I mean, just to outline for us, how many people get into a room? It happens annually, and tell us what they do.
Right. So it actually happens three times annually. There are three different meetings, and there are 31 doctors on this committee. There are 29 voting members. They usually meet in a hotel ballroom, and they quite literally get together, break up into smaller committees, and then get into a large group and vote on what the value of each procedure is. So let's take a heart stent, for example. They will actually break down that procedure and say, how long does it take a doctor to perform this? Everything from pre-operational waiting time to the equipment that is used to the amount of stress that a doctor is under while performing this, the post-operative time, re-seeing a patient after he's had one of a stent performed, everything, all the way down to these incredible details. They will literally list how many cotton balls will be used, or what a dime-sized dollop of antibacterial ointment. Everything gets quantified, and they then get together, and these doctors vote on what the relative value of this procedure is. And this is an important point because they're talking about relative value units, RVUs. And that is not, they will tell you, oh, we're not talking about price, we're not setting the price. But these relative value units are essentially identical to talking about price, because then every year the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid provide a multiplier. So then those RVUs are times 36, say, and then you get the price of that procedure. So it is once removed from price setting, but barely. And the doctors in there are really, you'll have the cardiologist sitting around and advocating for the RVU for a heart stent being higher than, say, setting a broken arm.
And you outlined there are several problems with this, but we should just say that in terms of this process, they come up with this figure. There's a set formula, so they know when they come up with a figure of, let's just say, 6 for the RVU, they know that it's going to go into this this function, and they know it's very easy to predict what the price of this is going to be. And the reality is that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, they accept these prices, or these RVUs, essentially, 90% of the time.
Right. So that's the other complication here, that people will hide behind the details. They'll say that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, CMS, don't actually have to accept the RUC's recommendations. The RUC is technically an independent advisory panel. And that means that it does not have to abide by the federal government rules for official advisory panels, which means they have to produce their conflicts of interest, they have to or publish their conflicts of interest and publish their minutes and things like that. This doesn't apply to the RUC. It's independent, convened by the AMA, as you mentioned. And so CMS could technically say, I don't want to accept any of those RVUs. That's crazy. But the reality is that there's just no other body coming up with the value for different procedures, given our current system that requires the Medicare to reimburse doctors according to each service that he or she performs, the fee-for-service system.
So they're the only game in town, and so there's no one to sort of push back on what they determine these prices should ultimately be. And what's also what's really problematic about this is that body, they're basically saying, this is what we deserve. Right? I mean, because this is a reflection. They're setting their own prices. And tell us about the makeup of this committee, which skews the how things are valued.
Right. And I think that's an important point that you just make. That these people are deciding how much they and their colleagues should make per procedure. And it's just crazy that this is the way it's set up. I mean, let's just take a moment and appreciate that. I mean, no other industry do you have plumbers get together in a room and decide how much it should cost to fix a leaky pipe. I mean, it's just nuts. And then the government will just pay, according to that price. You just have this kind of nutty setup that because it's Washington and nobody knows about it, really, or no one was paying attention to it, it's just sort of accepted.
Before we get to the makeup, we should say that when we set the prices for Medicare, that essentially has a ripple effect throughout the entire system of medicine in the entire country, whether it's public or private.
Right. That's the other thing about the system. You have to think of medicine and the medical industry, the medical economy, as sort of separate from the way a normal economy works. And the way someone described it to me was in Alice in Wonderland and kind of funhouse mirrors. But even if you think about it in your own life, you go in with say, bronchitis and pneumonia, and you're just very, very sick, and they want to give a certain drug to you or perform a certain procedure on you, you're not going to, you know, be going online and comparing prices, even if that was possible. You're just, it's very much a patient and their insurance companies pay the price that is offered to them. And so it's all automatically this kind of strange system. But then independent private insurance companies, have no way of setting the price for how much a stent should cost either. So they also rely on what Medicare pays for a stent, which by extension is what RUC decides Medicare should pay for a stent. So you kind of have this foggy, strange world of price setting inside the medical economy that then ripples all the way up to, you know, some person who has nothing to do with government healthcare is not on Medicare or Medicaid or anything else, and is just paying, say, Blue Cross Blue Shield. They also are affected by RUC's decisions.
And we should note that because Blue Cross Blue Shield or any of these private insurers don't have the bargaining strength of Medicare, that these prices end up sort of mushrooming out in a way, and they increase exponentially the further they get away from Medicare.
Exactly. And sometimes you'll see, private insurance companies paying 500% of what Medicare pays, 1,000% of what Medicare pays for different procedures.
And how does – and I want to get to the makeup of the committee in a moment. I mean, this is – this is such a sort of labyrinth in a way that it's sort of hard to sort of piece your way through. And that's why your piece struck me as being as so great, because it really does outline this well. But how does this relate – there were stories over the past couple of months about the rate sheets that different hospitals have. What is the interplay between those rate sheets and RUC? I mean, are they – I would imagine on some level they're based on those findings as well.
Right. Well, it gets back to the kind of Alice in Wonderland medical economy that I was talking about. The charge master sheets are actually not directly related to the RUC. That is, but it is insofar as you take this basic premise of there's no fixed cost for anything in medicine, just because we don't have a good ability to value our health and to value whether one procedure that makes us feel better is better than another procedure that makes us feel better that costs, twice as much. It's just if you compare our sort of medical system to Europe's, for example, we spend extraordinary, just so much more per patient, and we don't live any longer. We're actually not any healthier. And so how do you set that value? It's sort of an interesting thing. But these charge master sheets that you were referring to, hospitals will essentially make up, just make up out of thin air, how much a certain procedure should cost, and that's the price that they charge uninsured people and wealthy people from foreign countries and people who don't know that is essentially a price that is bargainable.
Right.
It's just insane. But that is not actually directly related to the RUC, only insofar as there isn't an established rate. There's no free economy for how much these things should cost.
And when the RUC gets together and they evaluate the value of these procedures, they are not evaluating the value to the health of the patient. They're evaluating it based upon what they think they deserve for doing this stuff. But it does not in any way involve outcomes.
Right. And that's kind of the craziest. I mean, that's the crux of it. That's there are these very elaborate calculations that go into establishing an RVU. And a lot of the doctors that I spoke to on the RUC would say, this is really hard work. No one wants to do this. It's incredibly bureaucratic. They will establish an RVU down to the hundredth percentage point. And it really does get down to, as I talked about before, how much physical stress, how much mental stress is the doctor under while performing this procedure, how much training was the doctor required, how much does that operating table cost, how many, you know, extra sheets do you need post-operation. It's just, it's absolutely down to the detail. And at no point is there a variable in there that shows, well, this procedure that we're talking about, procedure X, is actually more effective or actually helps patients get better more quickly than procedure Y, which costs half as much, but it's older.
That element, I think, is just we cannot understate how important that is. To use your plumbing analogy, it is as if the plumber comes in and says, "Well, I like to use a brass pipe instead of a steel pipe, or I like to use flexible plastic." We're not going to evaluate whether or not that's actually better for the application. We're just going to say how much it costs me to do it. And, you know, I like to do inscription on my pipes, because it's just, I liked a little flair on my piping. We're not going to evaluate how much that helps the result, that is, to get the water flow through or whatever it is. But we're just going to evaluate what it cost me to do that. And there's nothing tied to outcomes in this, which is so stunning. And it also makes the fact of the makeup of the ruck that much more problematic, because if you've got a couple of guys sitting on that, that committee who say, like, you know, I love to scrimshaw my pipes. I really think that's important. We got to evaluate that, and they dominate that committee. It's going to promote and incentivize more plumbing scrimshaw artists.
Exactly. I think that there's sort of that extra layer right there, which you're right, this is just such a complicated topic, but you brought up a very, very important point there, that the people who are making the medical devices, the people who are making the pipes, to continue this analogy, they are extraordinarily powerful actors in Washington. The medical device industry is wildly powerful and influential and wealthy. And they're the ones who are funding these medical societies that then the medical society elects one person to send to the RUC. And it's just, you know, the relationship there is just absolutely A to B. If your society benefits from a huge millions of dollars of money from a certain medical device, and then that a procedure comes up which they utilize that medical device instead of a different medical device that is perhaps just as good as this brand new scrimshawed filigreed pipe, then it would be in everybody's interest, and this is in fact what happens repeatedly, that the newest procedure using the newest sparkliest technology gets the highest RVU, which means that the doctors get paid the most for using the fanciest devices, for using the fanciest procedures, even when the fanciest procedures and the fanciest devices don't make us any healthier.
And that, after that sort of evaluation enters into the system, it sort of provides a feedback loop for doctors going forward. So what we end up doing is pushing doctors towards those specialty scrimshaw piping as opposed to primary care. Talk about the implications in that regard.
Yes, and now this finally gets back to the makeup of the committee itself. Of those 29 members, only four of them represent primary care. And by primary care, I mean evaluating the whole body. So, you know, geriatric physicians and pediatricians and family doctors and primary care doctors, you know, people who go in and look at your entire self rather than looking at just your foot or just your heart or something like that. And so as a result of that, you have primary care physicians tend to make most of their money through office visits, through consultations and discussing with the patient their symptoms and the different things that are leading to, say, back pain. You know, you'll have that could be a result of stress in your life. It could be a result of your mattress. It could be a result of your terrible commute. It could be a result of an accident you had playing football 20 years ago. There's lots of different things, but that the the diagnosis comes through a consultation, and it comes through this primary care venue. Given and those are the consultations are what are called E&M codes in the RVU language. Those are reimbursed at a much, much lower rate than procedures that use the fancy Scrimshaw piping that are newfangled and require expensive equipment and are invasive, essentially. So the way the whole system is set up is that primary care doctors are making less and less, while extremely specialized doctors are making more and more. This committee is dominated by specialists. And then that, you know, again, sort of telescoping out and looking at the whole system, a primary care doctor has to cycle through so many patients in a day, see a patient every 8 minutes, every 10 minutes, in order to bill for a consultation visit, which the RVU code for that is just really, really small. They can't make enough money to keep their practice open. And it makes the most sense for them, when this patient comes in with back pain, just to say, okay, go. I'm going to give you a referral. Go see a specialist. And then it's in the specialist's interest, of course, because he doesn't make very much money from consultations either, from just office visits, the same RVU. It's in his interest to recommend a fancy procedure, to recommend he gets paid more, and I don't mean to make these people sound evil either, where it's just like often the patients are clamoring for the more expensive treatment. They want to get better. They think that the newest technology is going to make their back pain go away most quickly. It's where a lot of us are psychologically when we're in pain. But it just does not make sense writ large. Most of the time, back pain is best treated by a new mattress and a change of lifestyle. It's not best treated by some $100,000 back surgery. But that is all of the incentives of our system is pushing us towards that $100 or $100,000 back surgery.
Both on the supply side and the demand side. I mean, like you say, you know, I go in and I'm a patient. Everything in my experience has taught me that if it costs more, it's got to be better for me. And
exactly.
That's on the demand side. On the supply side, we now have people who are sort of, we have doctors who are pushed into the, obviously, the more lucrative parts of the profession. We have a distortion in terms of the amount of primary care doctors. We have shortages in that respect. They're in the wrong places. I'm going to medical school and I've got a choice to pick which route I'm going to go. One's going to pay me $1.5 million more, you mentioned in the piece, over the course of my lifetime than another. I'm carrying all
right.
that debt. Why wouldn't I go in that direction? Unless I guess I was afraid of blood or whatever it was.
Right, yeah. There's been lots of studies on that, you know, trying to suss out why it is that medical students choose the fields that they go into. And money isn't everything, but money is certainly a factor. I mean, these kids are graduating with $250,000 in debt, and you're going to get more respect. It's more prestigious to be a specialized surgeon than it is to be a family practice doctor. It just is. It's how they're esteemed in society and how you're esteemed within the medical profession itself. It's sort of a cultural problem too at this point.
Okay, so now walk us back. Let's go back in time and tell us how we got here with this, because the story of how this sort of developed is reminiscent in some respects of how we ended up getting the Affordable Care Act in some respects. I mean, this is all about sort of getting a buy-in from some of the biggest forces that might oppose Medicare at the beginning anyways.
Right, right. So back in 1965, when we were trying to pass Medicare, it was, the big opponents were worried about this kind of destroying the medical profession. So one of the big concessions that liberals gave was that doctors would continue to be paid per service. I forget exactly what the phrase was. I think it was according to their usual reasonable or customary
Exactly.
Rate.
Exactly. Usual, customary, and reasonable rate for those services. But the problem was there was no real benchmark for what that was.
Exactly. I mean, it would cost a different amount to get a certain procedure done in Texas than it would in New Jersey, and as certain procedures that were really newfangled in the 60s or 70s, I think the example I use in the piece is cataract surgery. It's like, you know, that would have been a day-long procedure, very, very stressful, very required an enormous amount of skill, and it would have been reasonable that a doctor would be paid $4,000, $6,000 per procedure. Now, cataract surgeries are so routine, a doctor will knock one out every 20 minutes. It's no longer reasonable to have that sort of reimbursement. And yet, there was just nothing in place to sort of monitor for that. The doctors could say, well, this was my usual and customary rate for this procedure. You have to continue to pay me for it. So basically, fast forward to the mid-80s, and Medicare was just very nearly about to collapse. It was just a huge mess. And they called up a guy named William Shao, who's up at Harvard, and kind of asked him and his team to come up with fixed prices for each of the procedures to try to get past this usual customary problem. And he and his team, Shao and his team, rolled out this relative value unit scale solution. And I actually talked to Shao up at Harvard, and it's this very sort of elaborate system that relied on interviews with hundreds and hundreds of doctors from all different specialties and these debates, and kind of came up with these RVUs for each of the procedures. But then, of course, those have to be updated because, like the cataract surgery example, things get easier to do over time, and then new technologies are introduced, and those are harder, and doctors have to learn them, and the equipment is expensive, and they should be paid more for that. So there needs to be a committee in there that's in charge of updating these RVUs, and that is that in 1989, I believe it was, Congress got together and said, "Well, shoot, we need this committee. Are we going to form it in government?" And of course, that was the Bush. Bush one and his team did not like the smell of that at all. Didn't like the smell of a government price setting committee. So they handed it over to the American Medical Association, the biggest sort of most powerful single group in the medical industry at the time.
Does he now say that was the sort of the whole, because it seems like the system was premised on, we're going to do this very sort of rational procedure in which to develop the values of different, a rational process to develop the values of these procedures. And then the one thing that could sort of sink that whole system is if those people engaged in charge of the process had an inordinate amount of skin in the game as to the outcomes of those prices.
Precisely, and that's exactly what he said to me on the phone. He said that it was sort of his baby. I mean, he'd worked for years and years coming up with this very rational system of valuing procedures, and then it was handed over. It was made into a political process, which is what it is today.
And let's talk about so in his mind, it was going to be government, sort of like scientists or bureaucrats, who would determine this based upon a very rational process. And then it got all messed up because you put people in there who actually stood to gain from this. And one of the biggest gainers, I guess, from this, it appears to be the American Medical Association. Talk about how much they make off of this, aside from obviously the value it has to its, I guess, wealthiest members.
Right. I mean, the AMA's influence in the medical world has been declining over the past couple decades as these specialty societies have risen in influence and power and lobbying on the Hill, and for a variety of reasons. But AMA really kind of has an ace in the hole because it controls the ruck. And if you want to be on the ruck, then you have to pay, then your society has to pay AMA dues. And you know, in a year, the AMA makes about 40 million in dues, which, you know, I mean, it's hard to measure what they would be making if it wasn't for that. But the general consensus is that no one, and a doctor even told me that. He said, no one cares about the AMA. They care about the rock. So that's a little bit, in terms of influence, that's an immediate sort of ace in the hole, control over this extremely powerful organization or committee. And the second thing is that the AMA actually controls this certain code. It's called CPT code. And each of the medical procedures that you can think of, I've been using a cardiac stent as an example, each of them has its own 5-digit code. Every time you go in for an office visit, whether it's easy or intermediate or difficult, or every time you get a mole removed from your back or maybe a suspicious freckle biopsied, every single one of those procedures has a 5-digit code, and the AMA owns those. They own the CPT code.
So they basically own the whole sort of the mechanism. I mean, it's just that they own the whole system, it seems like. The whole billing system they own.
Exactly. They own the language. They own the language of billing in American healthcare. If when you go into your tiny little doctor's office in rural Missouri, or if you go into a giant hospital, you know, I don't know, in the center of Manhattan, if you get the same procedure, it's going to be billed, I guarantee you, using the same CPT code. It's just a common language, and anytime anyone wants to use these codes, you know, software companies, individual doctors, hospitals, they have to license get books and software or license the codes from the AMA. And that's another just enormous chunk of money for the AMA. I think it's about more than
83.1 million a year in owning that system. Now, because they basically are the gatekeepers to the RUC, they own the sort of the keys to the castle, as it were, and so they will always be there as that gatekeeper.
Right, and that's this kind of, when you talk about power inside of the Beltway, it's sort of difficult to describe it sometimes because it's all in these unquantifiable senses of influence. And if you just think about the fact that this one industry accounts for almost a fifth of our entire GDP. It's a $2.7 or $2.8 trillion a year. And essentially it all funnels in one way or another back to this organization and this committee. I mean, just the level of influence and power that buys is extraordinary.
And so let's talk about how this might be curtailed. I mean, there is some hope that parts of the Affordable Care Act might mitigate this, right? I mean, because they set up the Independent Payment Advisory Board, which is, it does not change the valuation of these procedures, but it at least says we're not going to recognize procedure X as one that is more, or we're going to determine whether or not procedure X is actually better in terms of outcomes than procedure Y, but the RUC still will set the prices for X and Y.
Right. Yeah. This does get complicated. I mean, the Affordable Health Care Act basically gives power to the government to, you know, separate themselves from the RUC if they were able to. I mean, the IPAB is the Independent Payment Advisory Board is one of these mechanisms that will that could be used to curtail the power of the RUC. But CMS, as I said before, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, doesn't actually have to accept the the prices of the RUC and that the RUC offers. And you're starting to see a little bit of pushback there. You do have some reformers over at CMS. Jonathan Bloom is one of them, who is starting to look with a gimlet eye on some of this stuff and say, you know, let's take a second look at these prices and at these values, and why are they going up for these procedures and not for others? And you have some advocacy organizations that are starting to separate what I was talking about before, the consultation, how much primary care docs are paid for just seeing a patient rather than performing a procedure on him. There's starting to be some moving and shaking and getting those docs paid a little bit more. That's not really, I mean, the way that the, one of the reformers described that to me is kind of like, you know, putting a new roof on a rotten house. You know, the basic structure of the house is deeply problematic.
And so what is the solution? Is it, I mean, it sounds like the RUC, the only solution to, you know, so that you'd actually have not a rotten house with a new roof is to make the RUC a function of government, really? I mean, right? I mean, the way that the William Shao had originally envisioned it.
Right. Making the RUC's process more transparent, making it abide by federal advisory board guidelines. As I mentioned before, I mean, there's some incremental fixes that would do an enormous amount of good. Doctors will bristle at the idea of having a government panel making these decisions. Those government panels can be populated by scientists, by doctors. It's just a matter of taking it out of the hands of this extraordinarily powerful, independent, special interest, the AMA. It just doesn't make sense to have it, to have such an enormous amount of power outside of government control like that. Reformers are pretty split on how exactly to reimagine the RUC, because as long as we have a fee-for-service system, we do have to kind of engage in this absurd a situation where we're assigning decimal points to the amount of stress that a doctor is under while performing a given procedure. That's just an element of the system as it's set up now.
So just give me your sense. We just got a minute or two here, but give me your sense of, this is the first I've heard about this. You mentioned that the Wall Street Journal, I think in your piece, had done some good reporting on this back in 2010. But is your sense that there's a greater awareness, as you're reporting this piece, a greater awareness of this, of the RUC and of its implications? I mean, is there any type of momentum here to reform this, or is it just something that we won't check in on for another 15 years or something?
Well, I think we are at an interesting moment here. I mean, there was three weeks after I published this piece, the Washington Post came out with a piece on the RUC as well that was sort of dealt with some of the nitty-gritty of how these RVUs are assigned. And that got a lot of attention as well. I think that when I started writing this, I mean, senators had never even heard of the RUC. People had no idea what this committee was, what it did. People inside Centers for Medicare and Medicaid had never even heard of the RUC before. Mm. I mean, it was very secretive, very behind closed doors, and now that's sort of starting to get busted open a little bit. So we are at a precipice. I think that this can change. But you also have to think about the enormous power and influence that would like to see the status quo maintained here. All of the specialty societies, almost all the specialty societies, the AMA, again, all of the medical device industries, the pharmaceutical industry, these are just really powerful actors. They give an enormous amount of money to Congress. They wield an enormous amount of influence inside the Beltway, and all of them have an interest in this not changing. So if it's going to change, it's going to be a major uphill battle on the part of reformers and people who are concerned about healthcare costs spiraling out of control.
Well, the piece is special deal. It is in this month's Washington Monthly. We will link to it at majority.fm. Haley Sweetland Edwards, thank you so much for walking us through it. It's a really important piece.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, folks. It is now that time. Matt said yesterday that I should be more pleading with oh, my gosh. Wow. Drudge, breaking news. Megyn Kelly taking over the 9 p.m. slot at Fox News. Poor Sean Hannity. Bam. Oh, boy. Wow, that is, that's pretty big news, isn't it? So where's Sean Hannity going to go?
I don't know. Maybe TBS.
He should have never gotten rid of Combs. Should have never gotten rid of Combs. That was the death knell for Hannity. It was just sputtering along. Alan Combs was the glue that held that whole ship together. Wow, you combine that with the fact that Cumulus is now at least making some noise about dropping Hannity and Limbaugh from their station group. They own WABC in New York. That's their flagship station for both those guys. And Hannity has always ridden in the wake of Limbaugh in terms of his radio career. If he loses that TV, wow. So, folks, stay tuned. Listen, here's the bottom line. I'm not trying to leverage anything. I'm not trying to give you an ultimatum. I'm not trying to threaten you in any way. But there's a lot of people out there who I know are going to be immediately saying, hey, Sam, maybe the way to grow your show is to bring a guy like Hannity on. Do a Hannity Cedar, or probably it would be a Cedar Hannity show. And then you wouldn't have to worry so much about, you get a whole new pool of potential members, conservatives, and then, you know, who knows?
You should tweet him with your proposition.
I'm not going to say that we're going to do that. I'm just saying that becoming a member would at least give you skin in the game from keeping that from happening. All right? So you don't want to show up here and have Hannity and I just imagine that interview with Haley Sweetland Edwards. About if it was done with both Hannity and I switching off on questions.
Can you give us an example?
Well, it would be something like, so Haley, are you saying that like the problem is that we have fee-for-service medicine as opposed to actually looking at the valuing medicine on outcomes? And then Hannity's follow-up question would be, Haley, why do you want to turn this into Putin's America?
When did you first encounter communism, Haley?
Haley, do you agree with the statement made by this one doctor that I have done research on who says that this is that we should be fully nationalized healthcare like the Brits or the waiting lines in Canada. So, folks, don't make me go there. Become a member today at majority.fm. It really is the way to ensure that I don't pair up with Hannity or end up doing like I don't know. Maybe Hannity Cedar on I don't know what I have no idea. In the better half, we're going to talk about Cory Booker, and there'll be more of Chief Kessler, the Pennsylvania police chief, who refers to you all as libtards.
And he actually regrets what he did. It seems like
what?
It seems like he regrets what he did.
Oh, yeah. And the new sound that we have of his, yeah, exactly. We'll also be playing that sound from Rick Santorum, who's going to explain to you why you libs are making it impossible to take showers. The story of a we're going to get to that fracking story about the gag order. Also, more on the NSA sharing its information with a special organization within the DEA, which then shares its information with all sorts of law enforcement agencies and encourages them to lie, even to the prosecutors, as to how they have compiled, they've made this case. Did you want to weigh in with something, Michael?
I just want to say also the Australian Sarah Palin is
coming
up on
yeah,
the better
this
half
is
as well.
Precious stuff. Yeah, we're going to have some fun in the better half of the program today. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 if you want to be a part of that. And the IM is, of course, at Majority FM. Please, folks. I know you're not supposed to roll out products in August. You're supposed to wait till September. But we've had we've just had I don't know what it is. But we've had just a rash of people who have had to cancel their paid memberships because of job loss, because of other unfortunate financial situations. So if you find yourself in a better financial situation, please support the program by becoming a member. It costs pennies a day. You can do so at majority.fm. You can also support the show by buying your Amazon junk. If you buy junk from Amazon, buy it through our link at majority.fm homepage. Click on the link, bookmark it, buy your stuff through there. You'll notice no difference. We get a kickback. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get a 10% discount, buy the Majority FM blend. Tomorrow on the program, Cliff Schechter will be here. And the Obama bot, Andy Kindler, will also be on the program. He is going to review, I guess, Adam Carolla's movie, which is yet to be made, but has apparently raised $1 million on Kickstarter.
Not Kickstarter. It makes it even worse. He raised it on Donald Trump's Kickstarter website.
Oh,
Donald Trump started his own Kickstarter.
Whoa, you're kidding.
Like his own like fundraising
Folks,
website.
Adam Carolla's getting $1 million to make a crappy movie, and I can't
Donald
get
Trump's
you,
getting a cut.
And I can't get you to become a member? Seriously. Oh my God. All right. Back in a minute.